Hey guys, this is And the Writer Is, and I'm your host, Ross Golan. I've written with hundreds of artists and writers over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life, the industry, politics, composition, whatever. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. I'm producing this with the great Joe London, Big Deal Music Publishing, and Mega House Music Management. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, follow us on our socials, find out about special events, or buy some of our merchandise, go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. Oh, and if you enjoy this podcast, please rate us on iTunes or whatever your preferred podcast listening site is. We really appreciate that effort.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. This week's writer, artist, producer is one of the greatest songwriters of my lifetime. With 16 number one songs out of 50 top 10 pop hits, and get this, 200 top 10 R&B hits, this man has sold over 500 million combined singles and albums. Not bad for a guy who only has 11 Grammys. If that wasn't enough, he co-founded LaFace, which became the home for Usher, Toni Braxton, TLC, Pink, and Outkast. From Indianapolis, Indiana, this philanthropist passionately helps those who struggle with diabetes as well as those who are fighting Alzheimer's. And the writer is the newly inducted Songwriter Hall of Famer, Kenny Babyface Edmonds. So how do you get started in music? I mean, are your parents musicians? Or I know you were in a band with your brothers.
Yeah, my mom, she sang in the choir a little bit. And my dad, he kind of just sung around the house a little bit. He'd record himself on a little tape recorder he had back then, way back then. And but other than that, he wasn't a professional singer or anything, but he had a pretty cool voice. He was a really good whistler. And we used to just kind of sit around and watch him sing into his little microphone, you know.
Was he making up things? Was he?
No, he sung like Nat King Cole songs.
Oh, sick.
And Jelly Roll and a couple things like that, but other than that, it was just music in the house, you know, just listen to the radio. And
you played a lot of instruments. Were they introducing you to a lot of?
I picked up guitar when I was in sixth grade, because my brother had brought a guitar inside the house, acoustic guitar. It wasn't his. He was borrowing it from a guy. He was in a band called the Soul Innovations. And he brought back this guitar in the house and told nobody not to touch it. Of course, I touched it. So he used to play this little lick, little riff, and I watched him play it. And my problem was I'm left-handed, and it was a right-handed guitar. And so he was right-handed, so I'd watch him play, so I had to watch it upside down. So I started teaching myself how to play, but upside down, because, you know, because I wasn't supposed to be playing it. So, one day he walked in the house and caught me playing it. And he said to me, he said, "You'll never be able to play it like I can play it." And I thought it was mean, but I thought, it just occurred to me now, maybe he said that because I'm left-handed. So he might not have been being mean at the time. So, but actually when he said that, it kind of just inspired me to like really work harder and try to be better than him. So,
when did you start writing? Like, well, when you were fiddling around with the guitar.
Well, that's actually why I picked up the guitar, because I was in sixth grade, and this girl named Rhonda Newbold had just moved into the neighborhood, and I fell in love with her first sight, and I wanted to write a song for her, and so I that little lick that I learned from my brother Melvin, I turned that into a song.
Do you remember what it was called?
Oh, Here I Go Falling in Love.
Did you sing it to her?
No way.
Really?
Of course not.
Can you sing it still?
Yeah, I play it in my show sometimes.
Really?
Yeah, if I'm just have the acoustic guitar, I'll go through all these songs I wrote when I'm like sixth grade and eighth grade, and because I was always falling in love and getting my heart broke, so I had a whole bunch of songs.
Where does that come from? Is just because you had a loving family, and so sort of, or like, where does that come from? That's presumptuous.
I started falling in love in kindergarten, so I don't know.
Who is that?
That was Debbie Mormon.
Nice.
In kindergarten. First grade was Hope Hopkins. Second, third, and fourth, nobody was cute those years. Fifth grade, had a crush on a fifth grade teacher, Mrs. Potter. And then sixth grade came Rhonda Newbolt, and that kind of changed the game. I kind of had a crush on Rhonda Newbolt all the way through eighth grade.
When you start playing music at that age, are your friends and family like encouraging you, saying, hey, you should keep playing? Are the girls in junior high, are they too young at that point to know how cool it is that...
Well, it was cool. It gave me a voice, put it that way, because I was a very shy kid. But then it was a musical house in the sense that, because my brother Melvin, he was in a group, and as I said, he had this group called the Soul Innovations. And so that same year when I was in sixth grade, he was doing a mixer at the high school that I ultimately went to. And the Jackson 5 were out at that point. And so he didn't have anybody to sing Michael's part for Who's Loving You. So he auditioned my brother and myself. And I won.
He auditioned me and your brother?
Me and my brother, Kevon. I ended up singing Who's Loving You at the mixer. So music was definitely a part of something. And Melvin was in this group, the Innovations. And he wasn't so much writing songs that much. I remember there's one song he wrote that I still remember. But he wasn't so much of a songwriter. Once I got on the guitar, that's kind of like all I did was, I wasn't really so much trying to learn songs on the radio. I was trying to learn how to write songs.
Sure.
My own songs.
What's the story about you disguising yourself to meet Jackson 5? Somebody told me to ask you that. So.
Well, that was in eighth grade. That was that eighth grade year, that was a crazy year because 1972, so much happened. It's hard to believe so much happened in that year. But like at the beginning of the year, my father passed away, January 2nd. But it was also that was also the same year that I had my first kiss with Rhonda Newbolt, and my first diss. She kissed me and dissed me at the same time.
Damn it, Rhonda.
Yeah, but another great song came out of that one.
Yeah.
But then the Jackson 5 thing happened. It was because when I was in sixth grade, I saw them, went to a concert and saw them doing the Going Back to Indiana concert. And I was blown away, and promised myself I'll meet them one day. And so when the eighth grade year came, that from somewhere in February, March, they were coming in, and I saw it in the newspaper. And so I decided, I looked in the newspaper and looked at who the promoter was, and the promoter's name was Charles Williams. So I called up every name in the phone book looking for Charles Williams, asking, is this the promoter for the show, for the Jackson 5 show? He said yes. Then I hung up, and I waited a day. And I called back the next day, and I called as a journalist, teacher, Mr. Clayton.
And that's who you said you were?
Yeah.
In eighth grade?
Yes.
Your voice doesn't sound like you're a
teacher. No, but I had a really good Jimmy Stewart impersonation.
Can you do it still?
Hi, this is Mr. Clayton. I'd love to talk to I was wondering if I could speak to is this Charles Williams? I heard that you got these guys, Jackson boys. So I went through the whole thing. And so I did that as an eighth grader. And I
used his voice. I said, my name is Mr. Clayton. I'm a teacher, journalist teacher at Wesleyan Junior High School. And I thought this would be great if I could have kids interview kids. And Charles goes, I think that's a great idea. He said, so how do I get in contact with you, Mr. Clayton? I said, here's what I'd like you to do. One of the kids, one of the students, his name's Kenny Edmonds, great student. I'm going to give you his phone number. And I'm going to let him set it up like a real journalist. So you can call him and he'll set the whole thing up. He said, great. So he called me 10 minutes later and I answered the phone like,
Were you so nervous?
Of course. Because my mom was at the house and she had seen me doing that, then she would have killed me. So, but it all worked out. He called and and I acted surprised that Mr. Clayton had set this up. And he told me, I'll let you know in a couple of weeks whether we can do it. And then he called me a couple of weeks that you got their interview. And so I was able to go interview the Jackson Five.
Did you tell, I mean, you had some relationship with Michael Jackson as like a...
Of course I told him, yeah.
So like, this had to be something that you guys talked about many times.
I told him and his and his brothers, Jermaine and everybody. Because I have there's a picture out there because I did it twice. And there's the second meeting, I have a picture out there in the hallway. But yeah, I met him a couple times. Of course, they don't remember.
Of course. Yeah, they meet. Yeah. That's amazing. So take me from basically that to, you know, becoming an artist. Because I assume that's first. I mean, actually, I know that's first. Before you get into really like writing for other people and stuff, internally, you're writing about all these, you know, the girls that you have these crushes on. So When is the moment that you start performing for people and saying, you know what? I'm not just a kid who's trying to like write songs at home, but I want other people to sing along to these.
Well, that was kind of all once in sixth grade, I sang with my brother in Soul Innovations. Then,
did Soul Innovations ever have a record deal, even a local one or anything like that?
They did not. Then I joined another group called the Indy Five, which is like the Jackson Five. And I never really did get to sing live with them. That never did work out. And then, that was in seventh grade. And then in eighth grade, then I started my own group, which was initially Gemini 8. That was a couple friends, Kenny Adams, Malcolm Gregory, Keithy Adams, Kenny Hamilton, Lloyd Crow. And so we had a little group and... initially, it was called Gemini 8, and for some reason, we changed the name to LC Soul Unlimited. I think because we started rehearsing over at Lloyd Crow's house, and he was the drummer, and so...
LC.
Yeah, so LC Soul Unlimited. And then we got a chance to perform live on this local TV show, Kenny Hannaton, his son, his dad had a connection down at this TV show called Clover Power, which was a local kind of show where they show pigs and stuff and crazy stuff. But interesting enough, the host of the show was none other than David Letterman.
Sick.
And so we actually performed on and sang The Love You Save on that show when I was in eighth grade. It was with the band called LC Soul Unlimited. And we were kind of famous on my street because when it came on that Saturday morning, you know, I was famous for a little bit. But that being said, even then, I was writing the songs, but we weren't performing them yet with the group. It wasn't until...
Why? Did you not want to present it to them, or
that wasn't something that we were thinking? We think we were supposed to be playing, you know, Jackson Five songs. And then I got to ninth grade, I was still writing songs, and I started writing more. I had my chance with Rhonda Newbold. I finally, you know, got to see her and spent the last day of school with her, and I had a two-week relationship with her, and it ended in a kiss and a diss, which was my first kiss. I didn't know, I wouldn't expect it. She said, kiss me, and I said, okay. And I kissed her. Then right after the kiss, then she said, we're not going to be able to see each other anymore. And long story. It was bad.
Cruel.
And so I left, walked down the street, had tears in my eyes, went straight to my guitar and picked up my guitar, and I walked for days. It feels like probably long as Forrest Gump walked in. and I wrote this song called The Bitter Taste of Life. And at that point, I just kept on writing songs. And then the next year, when ninth grade came, met this other girl named Tanita. I wrote Tanita. And then I wrote Too Shy. And so what happened was at the end of my eighth grade year, there's this guy named Emmanuel Officer that came over to my mom's house looking for me. And he asked my mom, he said, is this the house where the kid that sounds like Michael Jackson lives? Because it had become, you know, it was urban legend now that I sang at this thing in sixth grade. I sounded just like Michael Jackson, only better. And so she said, well, he did sing a Jackson 5 song once. I said, okay, well, we're trying to start a group, and I'd love to, you know, we want to meet him. We got to meet him. And so my mom told me about these guys. They were kind of awkward-looking kids that came over and looking for me, and then they left the phone number. So I called the phone number, and they asked me if I would come over to audition. So I went over there to audition. I took my little guitar that I had. It was actually a friend's guitar, and it was missing a string, the sixth string. So I was, for the longest time, I was playing with five-string guitar because I had no money to get another string. So I went over there to the house, and they asked me to sing, and they asked me to sing Michael Jackson song. Well, and sing with the record. Well, my voice had changed. I couldn't hit Michael notes anymore. So I went for it, and then they were all like, this is not the guy. And then I said, well, I got something else. And then they said, what? So I said, I got a couple songs I wrote. So I started to perform the song I wrote called Too Shy. And as I was doing that, then the father of the kids that lived in the house, he came down the stairs, and he goes, who's that? He goes, did you write that? And I said, yeah. He said, he goes, well, he's too good to be with y'all. Y'all just, and so then they hired me in the group at that point. That was the Elements. And in that group, we wrote a lot of our songs,
yeah,
and tried to perform them all the time. We might play little house parties. We played at the Wesleyan Junior High School, the talent shows. It was something that we would do. So it was part of who we were. So people at school, at my junior high school, kind of started to know I was a musician, and it kind of gave me a voice. And I actually was put in charge of the talent show. And all the kids would come, all the pretty girls and everybody would come into my house, and I was in charge. And so this kid who was really shy suddenly could talk to all the pretty girls. And I was popular, but I was not the one. I didn't know what to do with it. So it didn't matter. But it was, like I said, it gave me a voice.
It was empowering.
It showed me, you know, I became a person. I wasn't invisible. Because
right.
Otherwise, I totally would have been invisible. So music was, you know, the writing and the music was very much a part of my whole essence.
Do you still feel that way when you write, that part of the goal of writing is so that you're not invisible?
No.
Even after all, like, the huge success and all that stuff, like, when you still go into a room, you still go into a room and write, you know, you can't have someone else write your part. Like, you do what you do. Like, why do you write now? Is it at all the same motivation?
It's a good question. I'm not necessarily trying to be visible at this point. I think for a good part of my career, I wasn't necessarily trying to be visible. I was, as a celebrity or as a star or whatever like that, I've never always been kind of on the backside of that, you know?
Yeah.
But no, I write because it's what I love to do. It's great to write a great song and
sure,
and have other people perform it or me perform it myself. It's, you know, what better job can you have?
Sure. When did you start getting really sort of recognized as a writer and an artist, at least from your perspective? Like, is it when you get a record deal for you? Was it when you had your first, like, cut? Was it when you had your first single? I mean, those are such landmarks in a writer's career,
you know? It's a journey. There's different levels. And, you know, the first record deal that I got was joining a group called Manchild right out of high school. I graduated high school in 76 and got asked to join that group that right when I graduated. It was perfect because all my friends were going to college and I just woke up, wait a minute, I ain't playing for anything. Right. And they were going to school for music and I had just been in high school. I was in a band called Tarnished Silver that we played at all the everything at high school,
yeah,
you know, colleges and everything. And that was our lives. We played original songs too. And had fans of the school. But we were like also, we all copied the hell out of Earth, Wind & Fire. In fact, one time there was a guy from Boston that called us and said, hey, I just saw this group that stole all your stuff. Saw Earth, Wind & Fire. So that's how good we were at stealing their stuff. But it was... you know, the writing was a big piece of it, and always a part of it. And so going out of high school and joining Manchild and getting a record deal, okay, that's like, okay, I made it. But there's different levels of making it.
For real.
And getting a record deal doesn't necessarily mean that you made it. And I was able to put a couple songs on that album as well. But nothing. It had a regional hit. wasn't my song that kind of happened, and so I was in the Manchild for about 4 or 5 years, and it ended up not going anywhere. And then I ultimately left the group and started another group that didn't go anywhere. A group called April, and then I left that group and joined another group called the Crowd Pleasers out of...
It's a cool name.
They were in Ohio, in Michigan. I joined them. They were basically a top 40 band. And I got there, and then I started to try to get them to... Maybe we should be trying to get a record deal and let's write some songs. And
was it in Detroit?
It was actually all over Michigan. Uh-huh. Midland and Traverse City and Owosso and Lansing, Flint... We just were playing gigs there, which was perfect because it's like, that's the best place where you learn how to write songs, by playing top 40.
Oh, for sure.
You know, there's no better school than that, as long as you're paying attention.
It's also hard sometimes to differentiate yourself, though, when you're like competing with the other top 40 projects and you're like, man, how do you stick out?
The interesting thing, though, is like... Because when I was in Manchild, we were, you know, writing songs and a whole bit. And then we had did a few shows with Cameo when they had started off. And we were at the same level at one point, but then they kind of just took off because they were writing better songs and just cooler things. And we were writing cool stuff. We were like, you know, because we were being jazzy, we were kind of like into... jazz fusion stuff, and so mm-hmm. we were extra fancy, better musicians, and that didn't mean nothing. And so it took me being in the Crowd Pleasers and playing top 40 every day to kind of see what people like and what people dance to and what touches people. And that was part of learning how to write a hit song, not just a song, but a song that other people might actually want to listen to.
Huge difference.
So going through the school with Manchild was a funk band. I didn't have any funk skills at all. I was just an acoustic guitar player, James Taylor loving, you know, acoustic guitarist. And Waterfall, my nickname, they called me Waterfall because all I did was play pretty songs. And so I got my funk chops in Manchild, and then I got my top 40 chops in the Crowd Pleasers, and from the Crowd Pleasers, then I went and joined the group The Deal. And
there that's kind of like
when it started happening. So you have all these events that happen that you think are it, but mind you, all this time, there's no real success. Nobody's making any money. When I went to meet The Deal, it's my second time meeting L.A. Reid, I was in Cincinnati, Ohio, because I went there because I had written this one song that this group named Midnight Star had decided to record. It was a song called Slow Jam. And that was the first major song that I placed that actually made a difference, because I got my first statement, not the check, but a statement, because I was at Solar Records. And so they sent me a statement telling me, this is money, this is how much money I got coming. It was like a check for $5,000. I said, oh my God, this is what happens? You can actually make money from this? And so I was sold at that point, and I was writing like crazy at that point.
Once you hit the level of where you see, oh, if I write at this level,
yeah,
then the next song has to beat that. The next song has to beat that. Or you like in your head, at least, you know not to just try to write a song. You're like, nah, this can be better.
Yeah.
This can be better.
So it was, that was amazing. I didn't get that check for a very long time, by the way.
Are you sure it showed up?
It finally showed up, but it showed up way too late after my credit had gone bad, after I had got an American Express card and bought me a stereo and all kind of stuff. So learned my lesson there. But but the idea that I could actually make a living from writing songs. And at that point, I was writing songs all the time. While the rest of the band was going out and partying and everything like that, I was in my closet with my little Tascam 4-track writing and constantly coming up with more songs. Whether it was for myself or for the group or for whatever, it was like, if I heard something on the radio, then I want to write something close to that.
So when do you start writing with L.A. in that way? I mean, you said that was the second time you met him.
With L.A., I met him first at this club called The Zodiac in Indianapolis, where I saw The Deal. And I was very impressed with the band. It was right in the time when The Time and Prince were very hot. And so L.A. and The Deal, they were ahead of everybody else in Indianapolis. All the rest of the bands were not that cool. I mean, they had leg warmers and eyeliner and everything, and we were like, and it was some weird stuff for us initially, but then, and I was walking in there with the members only jacket, so I had no vibe whatsoever. That's when I moved up to Michigan, and when I was up in Michigan, that's when I changed my vibe. And there used to be this word, we called it breed. Just their whole look was it's the new breed. And so there was this guy in the group, guy named Hollywood, who was talking to L.A. on the phone while we were in Michigan in the Crowd Pleasers. And he tells L.A.'s on the phone, and I get on the phone, and I said, yeah, remember I met you down at Zodiac? He said, yeah. And I said, what you guys doing? He said, we're working with the Midnight Star, and they're doing some demos, and we got some songs we've written. And said, let me play you something. So he played me something over the phone, this song called Turn It Up. And this bass lick on it, and it was just all in the whole Time Prince thing. It was so bad. It was like, I was killing me. I was like, oh. And I'm stuck up here with these guys that are 65 years old and older. And I was like, I just felt like, ah, this is terrible. So I asked Hollywood, I said, ask L.A. if they need another guitar player or something. I would love to try to join the band. And he said, okay, I'll check with it, because Hollywood was trying to get in the group too. And so a few days went by, Hollywood never said anything to me. I said, Hollywood, so what did L.A. say? He said, he said he likes you and everything. He said, but you're just not breed enough. You ain't got enough breed. And I was thinking, yeah, but he ain't seen me. Because he was remembering the Members Only jacket. So coincidentally, when I went down to go see Midnight Star, as he said, they were working with Midnight Star was doing demos on them. And I went down to help Midnight Star record this song, Slow Jam, to demo it. And so I went in the studio and sang the song. LA had walked in while I was singing. He didn't know it was me behind the mic. And then they told him it was me. Then I came out and I had my new breed on. And so he's like, all right, you got a vibe. And then one of the guys, a guy named Jeff Cooper in Midnight Star, asked if I would stay and help them finish doing demos as they were preparing for Midnight Star, because they were Midnight Star was pretty busy and they couldn't do it as much. And I was really good on the four track in doing background vocals and doing demos. I had mastered it. My backgrounds were better than everybody's. So they said, we need you to kind of come down. Can you come down and help out? So I left the, I took some time off from the crowd pleasers for about a month and stayed down there to help them get these demos done. And in that process, I was able to write a couple songs as well, place a couple songs. And so the deal, they all went and took their pictures and everything, and I was not in the group. I was hanging out and watching. And they sent it off, and I had to go back with the crowd pleasers. So I'm up in Midland, Michigan.
Is Rock Steady in that group of songs?
Not that group, not yet.
Okay.
And so I'm in Midland, Michigan, and then I get back there, and then I get a call from LA telling me, guess what? I said, what's up? He said, the deal, we got a record deal. I said, well, great for y'all. And I was like, because I wasn't in the group. And he said, one other thing. I said, what's that? The guys voted and they want you to be a part of the group too. So my life was saved.
Hell yeah.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
But yeah, the songs like Rock Stadium, so they came much later.
Yeah.
You know.
When does the deal break up? Because that seems to be sort of like when you start really kind of getting into your solo stuff and when you get into writing for other people.
Kind of a long story, but while I was in the deal, when I joined the deal, I joined the deal as a guitarist, background singer, and a writer. I wasn't supposed to necessarily be the lead singer. Now, mind you, during that time, I was writing songs all the time. And so I was also submitting songs through Reggie Calloway to Dick Griffey, trying to get songs placed on the Whispers or whoever. And so I would do these demos all the time. So Dick Griffey, the president of Solar Records, would hear these demos. There was one song in particular called Sweet November that Dick had heard, and I submitted it for Midnight Star, for the Whispers. And he said, why doesn't the deal do this? The deal should do this song. And LA said, well, we don't really have anybody that can sing it. And he said, what are you talking about? You don't have anybody that can sing it. You got Kenny Edmonds. He can sing it. He said, ah, but he's not one of the lead singers, and he can't sing lead. And he said, what kind of sense does that make? He said, well, we voted in the group, and when Kenny was in the group, he didn't come in as a singer. And I wasn't pushing it. So Dick said, well, you need to fix that, and they need to go. He needs to sing it. So L.A. went and had a meeting with the group without me there to see if I could sing. They said no. So I was voted to not sing again. He talked back to Dick Griffey And by, this is our second album at this point. And at this point,
why were they so against you singing? Just because they the lead were holding.
Because I wasn't the lead singer. Because they were. Mm. And so this is our second album that me and L.A. ended up producing by default. Because Midnight Star would not produce us on the second album. So Dick sends back the message, well, if y'all want to have a record deal, then Kenny Evans needs to sing that song. If you don't want to have a record deal, then all right. Then that's it. So I got to sing the song.
Good for him, too.
And so that's kind of like a little bit of the history of kind of like with the group is like in terms of my position, I was kind of more the background guy and I wasn't trying to be the lead guy. And then Dick Griffey decided you should have a solo record. It's cool that you get the deal, but since they don't want you to sing, you need to sing more, so now you can have a solo record. So he created so that I could do this first solo album that I did. In the process, I had a little song called I Love You, Babe, and the deal, we were going out on tour, and so I had a little bit of I Love You, Babe to do, and but we had finally come up with this one song called Two Occasions. That was like the deal breakout hit for us. And we were out on tour. And at this point, LA and I were growing as producers and writers, and we were starting to get calls, and it was just like, we were so happy about it and so excited because we felt like we was Jimmy and Terry, and because we got to get on planes from, we was traveling, and the band didn't particularly like it because we'd leave dates and they call us jet setters. And so it wasn't so great. And the reality is that we weren't really making that much money out there. And the money that we were making from our production, we kind of kept putting our money in so the group could be out, equipment-wise and everything. We were taking care of everything and not really making anything. So we were just kind of just working for the band to be out. So there was a couple last shows that we were supposed to do. I made the mistake. I went to visit a friend somewhere, got on the plane, and I landed in the wrong city where the show was. I was supposed to go to...
Can't do that anymore.
New Roads. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I was supposed to go to Rhode Island, but I ended up in Atlantic City.
Yeah.
And when I landed there, I said, oh, I'm in the wrong place. I called... And the show was going on. I missed performing.
Yeah.
And at that point, I decided, you know what? I'm just going to quit. So when I got to the gig and L.A. met me, L.A. said, let's quit.
Oh, yeah. He was so waiting for
me. He was ready. Yeah. We were already kind of on the page because I was going to get a bunch of stuff for not being there. Although they didn't give me too much stuff about it. But we decided at that point that we wanted to just kind of concentrate on becoming, you know, producers and doing that.
How soon after that did, you know, I'm Your Baby Tonight for Whitney come out? I mean, is that like...
No, that was that's still a little time. And that's the thing is that all of this took a lot of time. It was, you know, from 87, that was probably from 80, we moved out to LA in 85.
Mm-hmm.
And, probably in 87 is when we did Rocksteady. So it was about 2 years in between there before of writing music, going to knocking on doors, going to Warner Brothers, going to Motown, trying to get people to take our music. They would not take it.
Even after Rocksteady? I mean...
Well, that was before Rocksteady, but all right. Rocksteady was in that. Some of those songs, sure. We played it. There were some songs that ultimately ended up being placed that people passed on.
Sure.
And that's just the way that it was. So you spent more time being rejected than you were being accepted.
It's still like that on some level.
Of course.
Sure. So by the time, you know, the list of songs that you have that start coming out, probably towards the end of that, you know, if you go 85 to 90 of like developing, then it's just like, you know, doors are open and 1990 comes in, and it's just like, it's an endless list of huge records. I mean, Whitney Houston cuts a record of yours at that time. Yeah. You had to be like already cashing that check also, right?
Well, I mean, yeah. So when the Whitney record came, Whitney came to us. We actually met with Clive Davis to try to work with Whitney earlier, and he wouldn't give her. He offered us Jennifer Holliday first, and we were like, nah, we'll wait. And so we had to wait it out. We only got Whitney because Whitney got in trouble. Because Whitney was, she needed to be a little blacker. Because she was starting to get a backlash of just being too pop. So Clive wanted to do a more R&B record. So we got in that way.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we wouldn't have gotten in that door. And funny enough, I'm Your Baby Tonight was not that R&B. But it was enough.
It's a pretty crazy melody. I mean, it's super melodic.
Yeah, it's
beautiful that it comes in the with the chorus, kind of.
Yeah. You know, so like, it's just not your typical R&B record.
Yeah.
At all.
Do you guys just write? I mean, up into this, do you still write from guitar and just being in the room or piano?
That was from keyboard.
Yeah.
I was just sitting at it and creating the track.
Yeah. Then Boys to Men. It's just kind of this, like, another just vehicle for smashes. When End of the Road comes out, there's a difference between sort of reinvigorating a famous artist like Whitney. There's another thing in being part of, like, the beginning. I know it's, you know, it wasn't Boyz II Men's first single, but, like, you know, to be part of that first batch and to sort of set the tone for somebody's doing that, that's got it. That feels like that's a different level of achieving. Well,
that was a surprise because, like, Boyz II Men, they were huge with the whole Motown Philly thing,
right?
And they had a little more R&B kind of thing.
I think it's my first CD. One of the first three or four CDs. Yeah.
So doing the End of the Road, kind of giving that whole Philly sound, it was an idea based off of the movie. But it was nothing that we saw coming in terms of the success of it. No one could have predicted it. And it became a staple for them. And it was a song that we recorded in very little time, went up to Philly and probably did it in 4 hours. And the magic was so easy.
Do you know that it's a smash when you're recording it after? Like, do you have a feeling? I mean, I know we have feelings sometimes we're wrong about it, but, like, when you're done in 4 hours of a song like that,
you don't know.
You know,
because of my personality, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't ever say, this is it, this is going to be a smash. I just don't do that. I hope it feels good, I hope it does good.
Of course.
It's just not part of me. So I can't ever tell you, I can't tell you one record that I've done and say, I knew it was going to be a smash.
Right, of course. And then, you know, I'm just going to kind of zoom through some of this because it's hard to keep up with it. But, you know, Bodyguard comes out as a soundtrack. And, I mean, as soundtracks go, that's just revolutionary.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
You know, it's like 40 million worldwide, yeah. Some 80 million, I don't know. A lot of millions worldwide. And then, you know, it's the next really most important iconic thing for you, and from looking at it, is when you have When Can I See You as your own song, sole producer, sole writer, and it's like, that's so hard to achieve. There are very few artists who've done that at all, but how do you even go back to writing with other people? What does that do to your life when all of a sudden you're, is that the end validation for a songwriter producer to be like, I did all of the crafting of this song? Or is it just, that's just that song?
That's just that song.
Yeah.
Yeah, I it's never been about me. It's always been about the songs. So the best home for the song is That's what it's always about. So certain people would lose songs because of that. I would lose songs because of that. I might love a song, but I know that I can't do justice like someone else could do. So I lose the song because of that. Vanessa Williams lost Girlfriend because of that. Pebbles got Girlfriend because she wasn't Girlfriend. And I was good for snatching a song back.
Who told you you were good for, like, did you know when you had that song? Because, I mean, we can name 100 artists that would have killed for that record. Were you saying, no, I need to release this one? Or was it somebody else who was like, yo, bro, you got to sing this. It's like, you're the right voice for this.
Well, I wrote it for myself and I wanted
to.
And I wanted to do an acoustic thing because I hadn't had a chance, because that's what I grew up doing, playing acoustic guitar. So I wanted to be able
Waterfall.
To introduce that. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. He's back.
All right.
And then you even get into some interesting things as far as, like, you know, when does La Face actually start?
It started in 89.
Yeah. So how much of your time is being delegated to sort of running a record label?
Well, fortunately, L.A. was really kind of the guy that was running it on day-to-day, and I was more music-oriented, so I was kind of like, I'd go to certain meetings and stuff, but for the most part, it was really just kind of like helping build the music. So, you know, so in terms of doing the Boomerang soundtrack and writing music for the artists that we had, the conflict that came sometimes was the fact that I didn't want to just do it for LaFace. I still wanted to write music for everybody. And Arista and LaFace kind of had trouble with that sometimes, because I didn't feel like I feel like it was going to kill me if I didn't write for other people.
Yeah, it puts you in a box for sure.
Yeah.
Do you still talk to Clive? And
yeah, I just did a album project with Clive, did Johnny Mathis' album.
That's awesome. I read his book, so he gives you guys some pretty solid shout-outs.
Oh, yeah. He was nice.
He was. Change the World for Eric Clapton wins Record of the Year. That seems sort of like out of like the normal, you know, wheelhouse of songs. How did that happen?
Kathy Nelson from MCA had called and said she had this. She was working for Disney and had this project for this film called Phenomenon, and she wanted to do this song that Winona Judd had recorded at one point. And they sent me this demo of Change the World, and it was so Beatlesque. And they said that they wanted that she wanted Eric Clapton to do it. And I couldn't imagine initially at first, but then Eric Clapton had agreed to do it, but he would only do it if I produced it. So she got me on the phone with him, and we talked about it. And then after talking about it, I said, "Well, let me figure this out. Let me figure out how to make this work." And that kind of what happened. I took the song and then kind of rearranged it and turned it into an Eric Clapton song,
and it worked out. You end up winning Producer of the Year for the Grammys from '96 to '98. Which it's hard to imagine. There are very few people who've won it once or twice. I mean, I know you're close to Foster, and there, we can name a few, but there aren't a lot of people who win it once, twice, three times in a row, and that's after being nominated, I think, three or four times before that. You start winning by, you know, once you become an individual producer. I know the nominations before that were with L.A.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's some artistic value in being like doing music alone? Like, is there anything in that like introspection that makes you a unique producer? Like, why is it that you as an individual producer so successful?
I think it was just timing, to be honest. I think that it could have just easily been me in LA as well.
Yeah.
Opportunities that were there that weren't there before. Mm-hmm. There were roads that because of When Can I See You, that's why I worked with Eric Clapton, because he heard When Can I See You. Man. That's why I work with Madonna, because of When Can I See You. So making that decision to go with that acoustic guitar made the difference in terms of, so every little thing that you do makes a difference in terms of who looks at you and who decides to work with you.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that the future may have been different, say, that had I done it with L.A. and we were kind of doing a completely different kind of music, I don't know that I would have got that look.
Sure.
And mind you, had I also made the choice that I'm only producing LaFace and Airstar artists, then I would have never worked with Madonna. I never would have worked with Eric Clapton. And there would have been a lot of things that wouldn't have happened. I probably wouldn't have done the Waiting to Exhale project then. So, you know, it's all of those things that, you know, the work that you do obviously is your, that's your resume. That's your card, your calling card.
Yeah. I mean, I pulled up We Belong Together, I think in a session maybe 2 weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's still, for the Mariah Carey record, it's so relevant as a song kind of now because it's very simplistic in how it's produced.
Yeah, simple things, yeah.
You know, and it just highlights her vocals so much. I imagine that that's like another one of those calling cards because, you know, you work with an Ariana Grande later or some of these big voices.
Yeah, no question.
It's like, you know.
Working with any of these artists, so over the... Over the years, at some point, it does come back to you in the work that you do. Yeah. There are young artists that know nothing of you, though.
Sure.
And so whatever you've done in the past, and if you can mention that you worked with a certain artist, then yeah, then it gives you some brownie points. But other than that.
Right. Well, I mean, you have Bieber and Beyonce and whatever. Your list is so incredibly unmatched. I imagine that there are a lot of people who would jump in. But that said, because I know we're running out of time, I'm going to list five people, and I just want you to say what first comes off the top of your head.
Okay.
Okay. Whitney Houston.
It's amazing to work with her in the studio. It was amazing to that first vocal that we did with I'm Your Baby Tonight. We were down in Atlanta. It was a little unbelievable that she was actually in the studio and she could sing like that. One of my favorite singers of all time. And we used to have such a good time and having fun in the studio and laughing. And it was, you know, she's missed for sure.
Yeah. Boys to Men.
Probably one of the easiest groups to work with in terms of, for me, songwriting and then producing, it's just easy. It's just like they know what to do, and everybody kind of knows their parts, and we just go for it.
Pink,
when she first came to LaFace, she was in a group called Choice, and knew immediately that she was a star, and that there's no way that she could just be in that group, and that she was going to be something amazing, and I wasn't wrong.
Clive Davis.
There aren't any more Clive Davises. There's only a few executives over the years that are real talent-driven and talented executives. And there's only been a few. They're almost non-existent now. And Clive is one of those.
Why are they non-existent?
Just don't make them like they used to.
Yeah. It's hard for people to develop artists now, too, in a lot of ways. So
They don't know.
Yeah.
They just don't know.
L.A. Reid.
Same thing. One of my best friends over all these years. Very proud of who he has become and what he's done with his career. He is one of those executives as well that I mentioned that they just don't make anymore. You have to understand artists and understand songs. And that's both Clive and L.A. understand that very well. And they've proven it time after time. And that's the key, you know. With L.A., he was able to prove it so many different places. And that's not easy to do. where you can go from one place to another and keep on having the same success.
No doubt. I wanted to give you a chance to talk about your philanthropy stuff, the things that you've been involved in for...
Yeah, I don't really push myself on that. I'm always supportive of, you know, of the Barbara Davis's her diabetes program that she's had for years, and she's always been behind it. And those are the heroes, people that really kind of like, they make that their living, and they have foundations. I'm one of those guys that you can call for your foundation that will be willing to help. So I don't try to put my name behind it and say, this is what I do. I'm just there to help when I can help.
Good man. What's a message you'd give to up-and-coming writers, or even, you know, successful writers, having been through this for as long as you have?
Everything ultimately comes down to a great song. No matter what, and no matter who you are, where you come from, there's a friend of mine that would always kind of, every now and then he'd get in financial trouble or something like that, and I always say to write your way out of it. A great song is a great song, no matter who it or where it comes from. Listen to other people's music and listen to what makes a song great and what makes it feel great, and then start working on trying to write that great song.
Do you have any sort of formula when you think of writing a great song?
Obviously, it's the obvious things: melody and groove and. What you're talking about?
Yeah.
Who's talking? Who's singing it? All those things are a part of it. One song isn't going to be a hit on another artist. So, but initially, a song can be great without having any artists attached to it. If it's acoustic guitar and just a simple song, simple melody, and the right words, and something that makes you stop and think. That is something that we all strive for. And we're always trying to write that better song. To this day, Stevie Wonder's still trying to write the better song.
Yeah.
So it's part of your DNA, is something that you always do.
Yeah. Well, I know for me it was when my parents could find a song of mine in a karaoke book. That's when they finally thought I was, like, they realized that I was a successful songwriter.
Yes.
And if that's the marker of what is a successful songwriter, my friends and I still, whenever we go into karaoke, there's like a rush to put in me and one of my best friends to sing End of the Road.
Oh, that's fine.
So, you know, your name comes up at the end of every one of, you know, every time you perform that song at a karaoke.
Right. Uh-huh.
At the end, it has you listed as a writer, and it's so hard to write a song that is a hit. It's really hard to write a song that you can just name the title and everyone can sing along to it. Or you just see a crowd of people singing along to it, and you don't even have to prep them. You don't even need the lyrics. Nobody's looking at those lyrics anymore, you know? But you have so many of these hits that really influence so many people. So thank you for leading the way. I appreciate you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much for doing this.
All right. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to David Silberstein from Mega House Music and Michael White. On the next episode, we sit down with Lindy Robbins. Until next time, this is Ross Golan.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince.
I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.